Farmland birds have suffered shocking declines in the last few decades, and yet with a little help from farmers, they will respond and bounce back. This is what Anthony Mooney, a farmer from Kildare, decided to do to make his land a magnet for birds. This is Ground Tips, a podcast from Farming for Nature, which brings you the best advice from Irish farmers to help you restore life back to the land. I'm Bridget Barry. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for joining me today.
Good morning, Bridget. Pleasure.
So, Anthony, you run a 200-acre beef farm near Maynooth in County Kildare, where you have a number of different habitats to entice bird species onto your land. Perhaps you could just start by describing your farm and your farming system for us, for those of us who haven't visited.
The farm, it's in the River Liffey Valley system. It's a heavy clay soil farm. It's most of it is very flat. It can be prone to flooding. There's some nice floods, nice big sizable floods here at the minute after all that rainfall we've had recently. It's a very suitable farm for grass production. High in lime, have a high pH. It will grow crops, but every now and again when the farm floods, things can go wrong. So it really is a grass farm. It has an interesting history to it in a way. Nearest place of note to it, of real note to it, I suppose, in historical terms, is Carton House. And that would have been the seat of the Duke of Leinster, and all the land around here would have been owned by the Duke of Leinster at one stage. And all properties around here were built by the Duke of Leinster.
So over time, you have been building habitats or allowing space on your land for birds. Yeah. Well, let's start with the obvious one that everyone should have on their farm, the hedgerow. You have beautiful thick hedgerows. Can you describe for the listener what a good, healthy hedgerow for birds looks like?
Well, a good, healthy hedgerow for birds, and it's been said so many times before, but I'm going to repeat it. It's a hedgerow that's allowed to blossom and bear fruit. Ideally, it should be 6-7 feet high, 8 feet high, and it should be wider at the bottom than at the top. It should be an A shape. It has to be cut because hedges are man-made. They're not a natural structure. They need some trimming, they need some cutting, but they should be cut in a way that allows a very good portion of the hedges on a farm, around a property anywhere, to blossom and to bear fruit. That's hugely important because hedgerow flowers and hedgerow fruit support an amazing amount of wildlife. All your pollinators up to your birds, all the mammals you have, they'll all get food from a hedgerow. And hedgerows are something that are on most farms. A lot of hedgerows are treated very well, but unfortunately, a lot of hedgerows should be treated differently. They shouldn't be given the kind of a traditional short back and sides. I just think a lot of people feel that a good hedge is a neat, tidy looking hedge that's trimmed annually. The thing is to let your hedge fruit, or should I say, let it blossom and let it bear fruit and watch what happens. That's a key thing. Just watch what happens to a hedge. When it's let do that, it supports an amazing amount of life, starting early in the year and finishing later in the year. It can go on all year feeding insects. When it comes to trimming hedges, what I try and do here, it's not a thing everyone could do, but I try and do it. I try and leave the fruit on the hedges for as long as possible through the winter to allow birds and all the other wildlife to benefit from the berries that are there. That means that, well, the hedge cutter is here now today with me and he's working away. And he will do about, when he's here this time, he'll do about a quarter of the hedges. He will do behind the electric fence and all the hedges because the electric fence is an essential tool here on a livestock farm. So he will just breast lightly behind the electric fence to keep growth off it. And the hedge won't be allowed up to a point where it can go beyond the reach of a hedge cutter. So we can let hedges up here up to 10 feet high, 10, 12 feet high, and we try and go for the A shape. If we're breasting, we'll only ever do one side of a hedge, and we'll only do that once every 3-4 years.
So you cut in rotation.
You cut in rotation. The idea being to maximise benefit of that hedge to wildlife. What I find enormous use here is shelter. If you're grazing cattle, a huge thing is to get the cattle out as early as you can in the year to get them, just to get them. It's how we finish cattle here. We finish them on grass here. So it's a huge thing to get cattle out early. If you've good hedges, hedges provide shelter for cattle or for sheep or for any livestock you have, for horses. And that's enormous. It means we can go out here. If we get the weather, we could be going out here from Patrick's Day on some of the drier fields. So hedges can be hugely beneficial economically to a farm as well as environmentally.
And presumably it provides, therefore, shade in the summer for the same kind of livestock.
It provides shade as well. Yeah, it provides shade in the summer as well for livestock. Now, we've planted hedges here on the farm. We've put in at least a kilometre, if not 2 kilometres of hedges here on the farm. And I think if a person is planting hedges, there are things you could consider. It's traditional, if you're planting a hedge, to go mainly for whitethorn. And that's, that'll be, people will use 90% whitethorn and maybe put in some other species as well. But there's so many other species out there that a person can use that are really beneficial. They will form an excellent barrier as a hedge, and they will blossom at various times of the year, and they'll provide fruit for wildlife and provide, and for yourself, and provide excellent shelter as well. When we were putting in hedges here, we put in maybe something like 20% whitethorn, and we always went for blackthorn here because blackthorn is one of the first bloomers of the year. Blackthorn actually puts out its flowers first, starting in March, and when the blossom is finished, the leaves come out then, which is a bit unusual. But what that means is that you have flowers early in the year, and therefore you have pollen and nectar for insects when they badly need it. When they need it early in the year, it's there in the year. And the fruit of that is slow. I don't know if you've ever drank slow gin.
Yeah, of course.
It's a lovely drink. It's one of the benefits of it. And of course, you have blackthorn sticks, which are, they're very well known, blackthorn sticks. And then it's a wonderful thorny barrier as well. Mm. So it can act as a very effective way of forming a field boundary.
But along the bases of your hedgerows, if we move out from the hedgerows now, you can encourage wildflowers. Do you have strips or do you allow your wildflowers to grow out from the base? Well, do you have strips of wildflowers?
If you want to encourage wildflower blossom near a hedge, keep your fertilizers, keep your slurries, keep your sprays well away from hedge margins. Keep them well away from the hedge margins. And you certainly will encourage different floral diversities to occur there at the base of a hedge. I think what's important too is that you do some grazing down low to the hedge. Some grazing, enough to keep your grasses back, but not enough that would discourage less dominant or less aggressive forms of plants from growing and blossoming there. So it is important to do some grazing up to the hedge. I find with a single strand of electric wire that your animals can reach in under the electric fence and do some grazing there. But on the farm here, there'd be an awful lot more floral diversity out in the fields than at the bases of the hedges themselves.
Another thing that you do is leave cutting your hay until quite late. Can you explain what you do and how this benefits ground nesting birds?
Okay, it's a huge thing here. And I'd imagine people were making hay, and if they observe it and watch it, it's of enormous benefit to wildlife. We were making silage here. We made silage here for years, and one or two things just occurred here over the years that made me consider making hay. About 20 years ago, I gave up using chemical fertilizer here for various reasons. I was never convinced of the financial benefit. I saw chemical fertilizers going out here, and shortly after we put them out, there could have been enormous amounts of rainfall. And I just got the feeling that an awful lot of the fertilizer, which is water soluble, of course, an awful lot of the fertilizer we used was ending up in water courses rather than staying on the soil, achieving the grown grasses, achieving the result we wanted it to achieve. So maybe 20 years ago, we went away from using chemical fertilizers here. And instead of that, we use farmyard manure and we use slurries. So we were trying to make silage here with unfertilized grass. Now, we found that that sort of material is more suitable for making hay than for making silage. It tends to be very dry in itself. It mightn't be as leafy as fertilized grass would be. But it's a much more natural product. And we switched to hay, I'd say, about 15 years ago, full-time to hay here, about 15 years ago. And we're getting on very well. Most years we get our hay made. We get it made very well. But we began to observe that all sorts of beneficial things to nature and to ourselves were happening when we switched to hay. Because we weren't using fertilizers, we found that we weren't encouraging very aggressive grasses, or we weren't encouraging, say, very aggressive non-grass species, say like thistle, say like other plants that would be very aggressive ones anyway. And our grass was slower growing. It took it maybe until late June, the end of June, early July to mature up and to get up to the yield that we wanted to get it to. And because of that, other plant species were getting a chance to grow. Less aggressive plant species might have been broadleaf species, in other words, non-grasses, and other grasses started coming in, other than, say, perennial or Italian ryegrasses. Other grasses started to come in. It was very interesting to observe it. And we'd have a great list of grasses growing here in our meadows. We'd have things like, we'd have sweet fernal, which gives good hay its essential sweet smell. We'd have crested dog's tails. We'd have Yorkshire fog. We'd have timothy. We'd have coxfoot. We'd have rough-stalked, smooth-stalked meadow grasses. We'd have a great list of grasses here. If you ask me, they add to the value of the crop as a food, as a feed, as a winter feed for cattle. This is of immense benefit to ground nesting birds. It's just to ground nesting birds now, and I'm talking about things like skylark. I'm talking about meadow pipit. I'm talking about a lot of the warblers there. You wouldn't think about, they'll actually nest low to the ground in grass. I'm talking about things like, I'll be talking about pheasant here. Nationally, you could be talking about things like curlew. You could be talking about snipe. You'd be talking about grey, partridge. You'd be talking about corncrake, species that are all, they're all in trouble and they all need help. The advantage of making hay is that these species, a lot of which are very early nesting, in other words, they could be starting to nest at the end of March, April, and they'd have their young, they'd have a nest full of eggs there, or their young hatching out at a time when a person might make silage, in other words, the end of May. So it's very hard for those birds to succeed in getting young off the ground if the field is going to be mowed at the end of May, early June. They're more likely to have dependent young there, or they're more likely to have eggs there. But by making hay, one delays the cutting of the meadow until a later date, and it gives those a chance to get their young safely reared. It also means, when you're making hay, that there's more feeding available there for the birds. There's a better quality habitat for them. So their young can grow faster and quicker, and they have a better chance of getting on the wing. The more floral diversity you have in a meadow, the more insects you'll have there. And insects are the food for all those ground nesting birds when they hatch at first.
So how does it make you feel to have all these different birds?
It's tremendous. Now, first of all, you have to remember they're endangered, so you won't see an awful lot of them. That's why we have to help them. But last year here, we had a pair of larks here. Now, it was in 2020, excuse me, we had a pair of larks here, and we were lucky enough to find the nest early on. Didn't like disturbing it, but we found four eggs in the nest. It was fantastic just to see those eggs there. And then we came back 10 days later. I crept out very, very quietly, found the nest and looked in, and there were four young larks in it.
Wow.
And it was magic.
So, Anthony, you flooded a field to provide home for lapwings. How did you do that?
Lapwings are they're an endangered bird. There's very, very few of them left in Ireland. The population is down enormously. It could be down 80-90%. And there is one small flock of them in the area here struggling to survive. They need wet land. They need wetland. That's what they actually need. Or if you have this wet tillage ground, they'll actually do well in that as well. But there is one small flock struggling here to survive in the area. It's about 2 miles from here. So I decided I'd give it a go. We picked the lowest field in the place and we found the main drain in it, and we blocked the main drain. We've had species using the wetland that I've never seen locally. We've had things like godwit, like black-tailed godwit. We've had widgeon in. We've had a good lot of snipe. We've had, I don't know what else is out there, but there's so many other species using it. I'm just hoping that I get lapwing in.
So the area you've chosen, in due course, will that still be an area that you'll be using for grazing in the summer?
Happened here last year was, we made an effort at it here last year, and what happened was we had water from, say, water on the site from, say, January through to about the first, second week of April. And after that, the water just receded and went away and the grass came back. And we grazed the field from then on. Now, if lapwing appear, it'll be a different story. I'll have to secure an area for them around their nests, if they appear, that I won't be allowing livestock in to graze. Lapwing should be finished. If it happens, lapwing should be finished nesting around July. And then if there's any chicks, if they're reared and are flying, livestock could be let back in again. It's an awful lot to ask a landowner to do, a farmer to do, but those birds are so scarce and they're in such trouble that they really need help. And they're the sort of things that people need to be doing.
Anthony, you've done quite extensive work on your land, or rather just leaving parts of it to coexist with birds.
Yeah.
And these actions might seem quite daunting to another farmer because it's, reflooding fields or leaving your hay quite late or so. But I suppose one place everyone can start is with their yard. Perhaps you can explain just some simple things that a farmer can consider to make their yard more bird friendly for nesting and for the birds.
The yard is a great place to start. And it's amazing if just a person observes their farmyard, or even observe your look. It doesn't have to be the farmyard. It can be the house, or it can be your garden. If you're not a farmer, if you're a landowner, just watch your garden, watch your house. Yeah, it's amazing what's around there. We do things here to help species that they'd be very popular to us. We'd really like them. One of the big things here is swallows. I love swallows because when they come to me, that the winter is over and you're into the better times of the year. So that very often the swallows will appear.
Sign of hope.
It's a great sign of hope. And the first swallow appeared here last year on the last day of March. I'll never forget, it was the last day of March. One swallow came in, sat on wires just outside the door into the house and sang. And it was great. So what we do here to help swallows, it's something you might have to think about for a while, but you can do it. The sheds here, all sheds here close to the house, there'll be stables, there'll be tool sheds, there's an old garage there, things like that. I will leave the window open and I let the swallows in and out. There's two tool sheds here. It's gas. Years ago, we had to put new doors on them, new metal doors. So when I was getting the doors made up, we left a gap between the frame, top of the door, and the top of the door, we left a gap between the frame and between the top of the door itself. It's about a 2-inch gap. And the swallows will happily zoom in and out of that. And they'll build their nests inside. It's usually the young birds that lean over the edge of the nest and deposit their poop underneath and on the ground. But you can do simply, you can put a sheet of paper, you can keep a space clear under the nest. You can put a sheet of plastic there. You can put a sheet of paper there. You can contain it. It can be as simple as that. It's a huge thing for birds like swallows. If you have swifts around, any house martins, if you have any of those birds around, they build mud nests. So what we do here, if you get into a dry time of the year, which you can in April or May when they're building their nests, mud just mightn't be available to them. But what I do here is I keep a pool of water out in the farmyard. There's a little hollow in the farmyard and I keep a pool of water there. It might be 6 feet by 6 feet. I'm able to run a tap and just keep the water there. And there's mud around the edges and I will continually see the swallows and house martins going down to the edge of that nest, picking up bits of mud and using it to build their nest. It's a simple little thing, but it makes a difference. And the rewards are huge. To have singing swallows and flying swallows all around the house and the yard here is enormous. It's enormous for me. We've done things here like we've put up swift boxes. Swifts are another bird that are in decline nationally, and they're a wonderful bird. They're not the fastest bird in Ireland, but I'm sure they're the second fastest bird. There's highly interesting things about swifts. They can go for years, actually years, without ever landing.
Amazing.
When a young swift leaves its nest, it can be up to 2 years before that bird will land again. They can feed on the wing, they can mate on the wing, they can do everything on the wing. The only thing is they actually need to land for are to sit on eggs. They can stay on the wing for everything else. And it's an incredible fact, but they can actually spend years in the air without landing. So if you want to help those birds, you can put up swift boxes. One of the things they always seem to be short of is a home to go to. But swift boxes are available there if a person looks them up. And you can put up a swift box on the side of your house and you can get a swift called. And you lure the swifts here. So we did it here 2 years ago, and we seem to be getting plenty of swifts in. They're a bird we didn't see locally around here before, around the house and yard, but we're seeing plenty of them now, and it's a lovely thing to see. One particular bird that I take an interest in here is a bird called a spotted flycatcher. It comes here in the spring from as far away as Africa. It's like the swallows. They're not very plentiful, but I find here if I have a plant growing on a wall, a shrub growing on a wall, and I have a trellis, they love that sort of thing. They're a very, very quiet, secretive bird. They only eat insects and they hunt insects. If you see one, they're lovely to watch. They're the very last of our immigrants to arrive here in the summer. They don't get here until June. It's a long journey from Africa, so I suppose they take their time. But we'd have them here. Lovely bird to see. But all the other birds as well, you know, your ordinary birds, the passerines, the perching singing birds, they'll avail of, you know, they'll avail of bushes, shrubs, you know, if you very often a little bit of untidiness will encourage things to nest. One of the, you know, I find here in the farmyard, one of the loveliest birds you can watch, and they're here all around, are wagtails, the pied wagtail, lovely bird to watch. They're very tolerant of human company. You'll see them around the farmyard. You can get very close to them. They'll often nest very close to the ground. I find here, if I had a pallet lying on the ground, if I had a machine lying on the ground there, if I had a machine, a grass harrow or something, they'll be in under it nesting. And they spend a lot of time on the ground running around, and I'll often see mammy and daddy wagtail with a couple of youngsters running around the yard here catching insects. Another lovely thing to see. We might consider in our families, we might consider owls, we might consider the birds of prey. They're a huge help to us because they take out a lot of rodents. But unfortunately, the one particular owl that we have, the barn owl, is in trouble. Its numbers are very scarce. Now, the good news is that it seems to be increasing. The increases are coming from the south of Ireland. But to help them, when it comes to, you have to just consider when it comes to rodent control around your farmyard. Unfortunately, a lot of the rat poison seem to end up in birds of prey. What happens is they're not going to go and eat the poison, but they will catch a rat that's, or a mouse that's eaten the poison. It might mean that it can be very easy for an owl to catch that. They can catch an owl, a rat that's still alive, or a mouse that's still alive that's eaten the poison. They eat the mouse, or they bring this poisoned rodent back to their young. Now, there's terrible consequences from that. You know, a whole nest of young barn owls can be lost. You can end up with sickened birds. Most of the birds of prey, any of them that are, you know, if they're found dead, and if they're examined, they nearly all contain traces of rodenticides in their systems. Now, you know, I know it's a person has to do rodent control around the yard. What I do here is I'd always make it a point, keep animal feedstuffs in rodent-proof containers. It's, you know, it's a sensible thing to do. So just to keep all animal feedstuffs in rodent-proof containers, try and consider other means of controlling them than using poison.
If you were to give another farmer 5 pieces of advice how to increase bird populations on their farm, what would these pieces of advice be? Short, distinct.
I don't know if I can come up with
quick fire answers there, Anthony.
I come up with as many. Well, first of all, I would start with hedges. There's hedges on nearly every farm. Let your hedges flower and bear fruit. The next piece of advice I would give to any landowner or any farmer is to give nature a little bit of your time by observing it. You're in a far better position to make choices about what you do on your land to help nature if you know a bit about it. And the way you learn something about nature is by observing it. The next thing I would say to somebody is get a buddy, get a friend. If it's another farmer or landowner, all the better who's interested in nature. If you're sharing this information, or if you're going down this journey with a friend, it's twice as rewarding. I would say there's organizations out there too that you could join. I'm involved in a pollinator group and I think it's fantastic. It's just getting to appreciate insects there, appreciating plants, just getting to appreciate plants in general. If take a big step and consider making hay, consider making some hay or consider making a small amount of it. Don't use fertilizer on that particular stretch. There's an enormous lot of things you can do around the farmyard. Neatness and tidiness is a wonderful thing and it looks great, but a little bit of clutter here and there, it can be really beneficial to wildlife
like and can help. How does it make you feel to have such thriving bird life on your farm? How does it make you feel?
For me, I like to be entertained on my farm. I'm a firm believer that you should enjoy your farm. And to me, it's all on-farm entertainment. And it's
live theatre.
It's just fantastic. It's just fantastic. I couldn't imagine myself farming without participating in nature and without enjoying it. I think it's wonderful. I just remember once here going out. We went out here at the end of May to make silage in the field, and I remember there was loads of clover and blossom in the field, and there was honeybees everywhere. And I was just watching the field being mowed, and all of a sudden bees were going around looking for something that wasn't there any longer. And I walked around the field, and I remember finding two young hares, two young leverets that had just been cut in half by the mower. And I remember just saying, oh gosh, I don't like that. I remember the first time we made hay here, first couple of times we made hay here, not using fertilizer. I remember all the blossom that came into it, all the flowers that came into it, how wonderful that was. And after that, I just remember seeing things like larks, like pipits, like hares, producing their young here and doing very well and having them here all year to watch and enjoy. And all those things were there to be seen and to be enjoyed.
Anthony Mooney, you're a great advocate for building habitats and birds. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks very much, Bridget. Great to talk to you. Bye.
If you liked this podcast, please rate, review and subscribe to the Farming for Nature podcast series. If you'd like to contact me, email info@farmingfornature.ie.